teaches a class in historical theology at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, winter quarter of the academic year 1964-65. Speaking to us is the Reverend Professor Carl Volz of the seminary staff. His subject is the Fourth Crusade. Mr. Volz has done special studies at Fordham University on the Crusade. Mr. Volz is a graduate of Concordia College, St. Paul. He received his B.D. and S.C.M. from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, master's degree from Washington University. He studied at Fordham and is at present in a doctoral program with that school. He was an instructor at our Concordia Collegiate Institute, Bronxville, and pastor of Christ Lutheran Church, Yonkers. He has been with us as professor since the beginning of the winter quarter in 1964. Professor Volz.
The Crusades occupy an extremely important position in the history of the West and of the Western Church. But unfortunately, an aura of romance and of unreality which has been inculcated into students ever since elementary school days, has robbed these extraordinary expeditions to the East of their real historical importance. A wealth of source material is available to the serious student who wishes to work on the Crusades. And now I'm going to give you some bibliographical material which may not appear on the notes before you. Perhaps the most significant single work is by Stephen Runciman. This name does appear on the notes, who wrote A History of the Crusades in three volumes, of which volume three has only recently been published. But rather than cite the books treating of the Crusades, let me give you a few names of contemporary scholars who are prominent in this study. Because if you look up any of these men in any library catalog, I'm sure that you'll get a wealth of material on any of the Crusades. In addition to Stephen Runciman is Dana C. Munro, M-U-N-R-O, at the University of Michigan. Another very important man is John Lamont, capital L-A, capital M-O-N-T-E, John Lamont. Another man is C. Brundage, B-R-U-N-D-A-G-E, who just this past December produced yet another work on the Crusades. About last June or July, a man by the name of Aziz Attia, A-T-I-Y-A, from Indiana University at Bloomington, Indiana, produced The Crusades, Historiography and Bibliography, an entire volume devoted to historiography and bibliography of the Crusades. Another important name is Hill, a husband and wife team, J.H. Hill. Both Mr. and Mrs. Hill write on the Crusades. Kenneth Seton, S-E-T-T-O-N, has written a five-volume work on the history of the Crusades. There is a collection of sources of source material on the Crusades, recouled as historians, as Croisades, French work, which hasn't been translated into English. These are all general works, but for the serious scholar of the Crusades, each individual crusade has its own bibliography. For instance, the prime sources for the Fourth Crusade are before you. And any serious student is going to have to look up the bibliography for his particular crusade. When we refer to the Crusades by number, we are following a pattern established by historians in the Renaissance. But we must always realize that numbering Crusades is a difficult, an artificial, and actually an impossible task. For instance, within the so-called First Crusade, there were at least four Crusades. The first waves to arrive were German, were French. The second to arrive were German. Then came the Lombards, and not to be outdone by the others, finally came the Normans. All these came within a period of 4 or 5 years, which is generally known as the First Crusade, but we could just as easily say these were the first five Crusades. The so-called Second Crusade consisted of at least two different waves of Frenchmen and Germans, arriving in Palestine at different times and pursuing different goals. Yet we combine them under Second Crusade. The Third Crusade, or the Crusade of the Three Kings, which is probably the one which has been romanticized more than any other, because of the imprisonment of Richard the Lionhearted. And I believe Robin Hood was going through his adventures at this time, too. Well, this Third Crusade was also a series of invasions. In fact, Richard of England hadn't even started out when Friedrich Barbarossa drowned and the German wave returned home. From 1095 until 1291, 1291 is the date usually assigned to the end of the Crusades. Crusading was a continuous phenomenon. Numbers are assigned to those Crusades which assumed some kind of organization under recognized leaders. The study of the Crusades occupies a large amount of interest on the part of medievalists. For example, at least one university, an entire semester's course from September through January is devoted to the first four Crusades, and then the material is hardly exhausted. Before speaking of the Fourth Crusade specifically, allow me to make some general observations on the significance and the ideology of the Crusades. If you look at the outline before you, I'm starting now with the significance of the Crusades, which has to be brief, naturally, but we'll just mention some factors which probably are obvious already. The Crusades were a manifestation of religious zeal and spiritual rebirth stimulated by the Gregorian reforms of the 11th century. In this context, we could go back to Cluny, 910, and say that because of the Cluniac reforms, we have this spiritual regeneration, this increased fervor in Europe. Because of the Hildebrandine or Cluniac reforms, we have a spiritual rebirth, revival of religious zeal in the 11th century. The Crusades died out only after the secularization of the West during the 14th century, which in turn was brought about to a large degree by the Crusades themselves. In other words, the Crusades committed suicide. The more successful they were, the more secularized the West became. And the more secularized the West became, the more the crusading zeal retreated. But religious fervor was hardly the sole motive underlying the Crusades. Another factor was political. A golden opportunity for position and renown was open to the poor nobility. A political factor. So we have a religious, we have a political. A third factor was the desire for wealth, but we're not speaking only of personal gain. We're speaking of the corporate desire for wealth, especially in the cities of Pisa, Genoa, and above all, Venice, who engaged in widespread colonization as a result of the Crusades. Hundreds of colonies were established in the east, around the Black Sea, in the Levant, by these three Italian cities, which in turn stimulated commerce from the east. And this would be a fourth factor, the stimulation of commerce. Since feudalism was based on a landed agrarian economy, the Crusades served to undermine the old system in favor of the capitalistic ideal. Feudalism is an economic and political system based on land ownership. We might say it is landed economy. It is not currency. It is not a capitalistic system. But the Crusades stimulated a different kind of economy, and in so doing undermined the feudal system. The Crusades also served as a leveling between nobility and commoners, since in the new land, all former class distinctions tended to become obliterated. In the feudal system, land made the man. And a man was a nobleman if he happened to live on noble land. A man was a peasant if he happened to live on land which owed services. Land made the man. But in the Holy Land, a nobleman and a peasant could be on an equal footing because each of them, by force of his own arms, had conquered a certain territory. And in this respect, it served as a great leveling factor. Secondly, the ideology of the Crusades. A vast amount of literature exists on the problem of ideology. At least 10 learned books have been published in the last 40 years dealing with the problem of ideology. Most recent is perhaps by Villeley, V-I-L-L-E-Y, who wrote a book entitled A Juridical Theory Concerning the Formation of a Crusade. A juridical theory concerning the formation of a crusade. At least two influences are present in a crusade. First, the idea of a holy war, the idea of arms, of a holy war, a justified war. And secondly, the idea of pilgrimage. Both ideals are present already as early as the 8th century, and we might here say that the first crusade was called in the 9th century, except there were no takers. One recent definition of a crusade is by Rousset, R-O-U-S-S-E-T, and this is the way in which he defined it. A true crusade is a military expedition summoned by the Pope, preached by the clergy against the infidel to recover the Holy Land. Many crusades, so-called, would not fit this description. The Albigensian crusade was by the Pope against the Albigensians, not against the infidel. Rousset says that there are three requisites for a crusade. First of all, the indulgence. Secondly, the vow. And thirdly, as symbol of the vow, the wearing of a cross. The most important and novel ingredient is the indulgence. The idea of the plenary indulgence came into canon law through the Crusades. The idea of having temporal punishment for sin remitted if you go on the crusade. The first plenary indulgence was issued by Pope Urban II at Clermont, 1095, in his speech to the council. And from there on, the plenary indulgence was used more frequently in other areas. Richard O'Callaghan of Fordham simply defines a crusade as an indulgenced holy war. The legal and juridical bases of the Crusades are difficult to assess since it involves the problem of church and state in the Middle Ages. Questions such as the church's sanction, the pope's indulgence, the king or emperor's participation, all involve us in the basic problem of church and state. and in the short time today, we can't outline the various views held by the historians. But I can say that at the present time, within the medieval academy, there are articles being written, books being written, and men becoming very much engrossed in this problem of the juridical basis of a crusade, the legal basis. Suffice it to say that the Crusades combined elements of holy war and pilgrimage, encouraged and blessed by the Church. Now to proceed to one specific crusade, the fourth, so-called. The following outline which you have before you has been condensed considerably from a paper delivered in the graduate school at Fordham during the summer of 1961 on the Fourth Crusade. In 1198, a vigorous new pope ascended the throne of Peter, Innocent III. And people, together with the pope, felt the time was propitious for a fresh crusade. And so Innocent, in 1198, called for the crusade. The initial call came from the pope. 4 years later, the crusaders assembled in Venice, October 1202. 1 month later, they sacked the Christian city of Zara in Dalmatia. From Zara, the crusaders proceeded to Constantinople, which was also sacked and razed, 1204, thus ending the Fourth Crusade. Thus, for the first time, you see, there's Zara. Venice up here. And Zara should be right about here. Right there is Zara. Then from there they went to Durazzo. There they went around up here to Constantinople. 1204, Constantinople fell, ending the Fourth Crusade. Thus, for the first time, the crusaders attacked fellow Christians instead of the Muslims. The burden of this presentation of the Fourth Crusade is to answer the question, why? This is not merely going to be a descriptive account of a crusade, but we're going to ask the question, why? Why was it diverted from its original purpose, and what were the factors in the diversion? The two most important primary sources for the Fourth Crusade are by, first of all, Geoffrey Villehardouin. I believe that's on the primary sources of your sheets. And the second is by Robert of Clary. This paper has been very much dependent upon these two sources. Incidentally, Villehardouin's History of the Fourth Crusade has been equated to Luther's German Bible for influencing the development of the French language. There are some people who, some linguistic historians who claim that Villehardouin is just as important for French as the German Bible is for German. It is the first important literary masterpiece in the old French language. In order to answer the question, why was the Fourth Crusade diverted, we will first of all discuss the positions or backgrounds of the prominent parties in the crusade. First of all, we have Philip of Swabia and Boniface of Montferrat. If you remember your knowledge of medieval history, Friedrich Barbarossa died in 1190, drowned in a river while he was en route to the Holy Land on the Third Crusade, 1190. His son, Henry VI, succeeded him to the throne. Now, Henry VI's political position was precarious. On the one hand, he was fighting the papacy, and on the other hand, the Normans of southern Italy. And so, in order to ingratiate himself with at least one enemy, he promised the Pope, Celestine III, that he would leave on a crusade, provided in turn the Pope would make his son, Frederick II, the great Frederick II, King of Rome. Well, the compact was agreed to, but unfortunately, Henry VI died in 1197, and the crusade did not materialize. Now, this is going to be somewhat complicated, so if you want to make diagrams, it may help for you to say that Friedrich Barbarossa would be at the top of the lineal descent. One of his sons was Henry VI. Another one of his sons was Philip of Swabia. Henry VI had a son who was later Frederick II, 1215 to 1250. When Henry VI died in 1197, this man, Philip of Swabia, became regent for Frederick II. Now, Philip of Swabia not only wanted to fulfill his brother's ambitions in leading a crusade, but there were other important personal reasons for a crusade. Over in Constantinople, the emperor is Isaac Angelus. Isaac has a daughter by the name of Irene and a son by the name of Alexius IV. Isaac Angelus also has a brother by the name of Alexius III. Philip of Swabia married Irene. Sometime later, Isaac Angelus' brother, Alexander III, in good fraternal fashion, blinded his brother and imprisoned him and usurped the throne. He also imprisoned his young nephew, Alexius IV. While the Fourth Crusade was being assembled in Venice, Alexius IV escaped from prison, came to his brother-in-law's house, Philip of Swabia, and tried to persuade him to come to Constantinople to restore Isaac to the throne. So you begin to see some of the reasons for a diversion to Constantinople. Boniface of Montferrat had a younger brother, Conrad, who had been treacherously dealt with by a former ruler of Constantinople. Robert of Clary recounts at length a history of broken promises, treachery, and intrigue, and attempted assassination. For this reason, Boniface, who was the leader of the Crusade, Boniface of Montferrat was the leader of the Fourth Crusade, had personal reasons for attacking Constantinople. But when we look at the Fourth Crusade, we can't say that it was these men who led it astray. There are other factors. Secondly, the Venetians. From 1143 on, Byzantium favored Pisa and Genoa in its commerce. Sometime after 1150, the entire Dalmatian coast, over here, the entire Dalmatian coast came under the rulership of the King of Hungary, including the city of Zara. Right up in there. Came under the domination of Hungary. Venice sent four expeditions to Zara, which until this time had been one of her most important commercial contacts. But she was repulsed each time. The usurper in Constantinople, Alexius III, followed a policy of near hostility to Venice. And Venice, you know, either lived or died by commerce, as does any island empire. Thus, at the turn of the century, Venice was nursing a history of frustrated desire for her so-called lost colony of Zara. In addition to losing her privileged status in Constantinople. Besides, the Venetians believed, there are many, many footnotes available on this, but the Venetians believed that their doge, on a trip to Constantinople in order to straighten out affairs, had been tortured and blinded. We know that he was blind. Whether the Constantinopolitans did it, we don't know. But the Venetians believed that they had, and therefore they had also personal reasons for fighting Constantinople. Thirdly, Alexius III, the IV, and Isaac Angelus. I already described this relationship to you on the board. In 1195, Isaac was ruling, but in that same year, Alexius III seized and blinded him and imprisoned him together with his son, Alexius IV. And Alexius IV, in 1201, escaped and made his way to Philip, his brother-in-law, with a plea for assistance. And finally, number four, the fourth important personage is Innocent. A quotation from Herder, History of Innocent II, Volume 1, is as follows. During the 18 years of his reign, the most absorbing thought of Innocent III, the purpose to which he most constantly adhered, was the deliverance of the Holy Land. The time was propitious for Europe to engage in extra-European activities. Matter of fact, Innocent III thought this would serve, as the first three did, three crusades, as a safety valve. At this time, John was fighting against Arthur in England. Philip Augustus, Philip II, was fighting against John's pretensions in France. In Germany, we have the struggle between the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. And so Innocent III thought that he could probably restore some kind of unity or harmony to Europe and at the same time recover the Holy Land. Now, as to the resume of the crusade itself. First of all, the diversion to Zara. Remember that Innocent called for this crusade in 1198. By 1200, the leaders had met at Soissons. The leaders sent envoys to Pisa and Genoa to secure transportation. But Pisa and Genoa were unable to help, and so the crusaders were forced to seek assistance at Venice. The Venetian council deliberated for 8 days and finally agreed to provide ships. Listen to these numbers. This is quite a logistics problem. For 4,500 horses, for 9,000 squires, 4,500 knights, 20,000 infantry, together with provisions for 9 months. They promised to do all this at a cost of 85,000 marks. Remember, they're businessmen. Also, Venice insisted in controlling half of the conquered territory. They're good business. The Doge also promised, in addition, 50 armed galleys to accompany the fleet, quote, for the fear of God, and whatever enemies they would meet. After Mass in St. Mark's Cathedral, the contract was ratified, April of 1201. The Crusaders agreed to attack Cairo in Egypt because they thought this was the best way of getting at the Muslims at this time. This was their real center of power. But only the leaders, Philip, Boniface, and about 18 others, knew this. A copy of the contract was sent to Innocent, who reluctantly agreed to its terms, provided, he said, that no Christian city was attacked. So already Innocent was suspicious. Ernoul, E-R-N-O-U-L, he is on your primary source list. The earliest historian of the Crusade reports that 1 month after the contract had been signed, the Sultan in Cairo, who of course heard that he would be the object of their attention, the Sultan in Cairo approached Dandolo, the Doge of Venice, with gifts and trade concessions, provided Dandolo would in some way avert the crusade from Egyptian shores. This is all happening in the summer of 1201. In August, Boniface was appointed leader of the crusade, and he immediately traveled to Philip of Swabia and spent some weeks with him. This, I think, is significant. We don't know what happened while they were talking, but I have a few more references to this meeting in the summer between Boniface and Philip. The Gesta Innocenti, the works of Innocent III, reports that Boniface went to Philip, quote, where he was reported to have discussed with Philip of Swabia, who had assumed the title of king, a plan consisting in bringing back the runaway prince Alexius to Constantinople with the help of Christian arms. And there are quite a few other references to this meeting between Philip and Boniface trying to determine exactly what happened. But we do know this, that by this time Alexius had escaped, and Alexius was at court with Philip when Boniface, the leader of the crusade, arrived there. This is late summer 1201. Early during 1202, pilgrims began arriving at Venice, but many already, suspecting some kind of Venetian duplicity, sought their own way from other ports. On the day set for departure, June 24th, the crusaders still lacked 34,000 of the 85,000 marks. It was at this time that Dandolo proposed the conquest of Zara, for which he said the debt of 34,000 would be remitted. Many crusaders now left for home in disgust at this piece of duplicity. Innocent condemned the proposal, but late in October, the fleet finally left, 1202, bound for Zara. Although the citizens of Zara sent delegates with peace proposals, it was besieged for 5 days and fell. Innocent III immediately excommunicated every person who had taken part in the affair. But the bull of excommunication was sent to Boniface as the leader of the crusade, but he refused to make its contents known for fear of the unnecessary alarm it would cause among the crusaders. This is late 1202. The army decided now to spend the winter with the unfortunate inhabitants of Zara. The story of intrigue and diplomacy, I was going to say duplicity, but that would be right too, during this winter fills many pages in the chronicles. Robert of Clary gives it to you almost day by day, things that were happening. As far as the crusaders knew, they would be bound for Palestine in the spring, since their nefarious bargain with Venice had been carried out. But the debates among the leaders were long and vitriolic. Many light knights left for home. Then on New Year's Day, 1203, young Alexius IV made an offer to the leaders. If they would help him to recapture the throne in Constantinople, he in turn promised the following. First, he would bring the Byzantine church back to the west, thus healing the schism which started in 1054. Secondly, he would give 200,000 gold pieces to each crusader. Thirdly, he would send 10,000 men to fight in Palestine. So you see, if they would help to restore him to the throne, they would also be helping the people, the Christians in Palestine. And finally, he would maintain in perpetuity 10,000 knights in the Holy Land. In other words, he pointed out that by helping him, the crusaders would also be furthering their own cause of liberating Palestine. Meanwhile, Innocent granted a conditional pardon to all who had taken part in the Zara affair, provided no Christian city would ever be attacked again. By March, the leaders of the crusade had ratified a new contract with Venice by which they would assist in taking Constantinople. However, when the host of crusaders heard of the plan, about 60% deserted. The leaders, however, gave them, the defectors, ironclad promises that by October they would definitely sail for the Holy Land, and on the strength of this promise, many of them remained with the army. In June 1203, the fleets came into the harbor of Constantinople. Much has been written about the siege of Constantinople. You have in your bibliography a book by the Peers, an entire volume given over to this siege and to the fall of Constantinople. We're not going to go into it, but just say that the city was stormed in July. Alexander III, the usurper, fled. Alexius IV was crowned co-emperor with his father Isaac Angelus. And so the immediate goal of restoring Alexius III had been accomplished. Alexius III, however, discovered himself in difficulty. Dissensions were rife between Greeks and pilgrims, pilgrims and Alexius, Alexius and the Greeks, and no one from any quarter befriended the Venetians. Alexius did not wish for the crusaders to move on to Palestine, since his own position in Constantinople was precarious. The people were hardly behind Alexius III. And so the crusaders were persuaded to winter at Constantinople. As the winter wore on, the crusaders became more impatient with Alexius, who had failed to redeem any one of his promises. Early in 1204, there was a palace revolution wherein Murzuphlos, M-U-R-Z-U-P-H-L-O-S, means heavy eyebrows, Murzuphlos, son of the deposed Alexander III, killed both Alexius IV and Isaac and usurped the throne. Murzuphlos then appealed to the Greeks to rally behind him in expelling the crusaders. Thus the stage was set for the final humiliation of the great city. On April 12, 1204, Constantinople was occupied by the Venetians and Crusaders, who subjected it to a three-day pillage. And I might say that this is the first time in world history anyone ever took the city of Constantinople. Then Baldwin, Count of Flanders, was crowned emperor. We're going to have in Constantinople now until 1261, the Latin Kingdom of Constantinople. Baldwin is the first emperor. The Venetian, Thomas Morosini, was elected patriarch. The Latin rites and language were made mandatory, and the patriarchs formally announced an end to the schism between the Eastern and Western Church. Innocent III, though he denounced the entire affair with scathing invective, knew that nothing more constructive could be accomplished, and so he had to acquiesce. He absolved all the crusaders from the journey to Palestine, and the crusade was at an end. Now, to conclude, there are some important factors involved in the fall of Constantinople in 1204. After all, this is the most important part, the continuing significance. As just an historic event by itself, no history is worth, is worth giving much attention to. But the Fourth Crusade is especially important for the following reason. In sum, the Fourth Crusade resulted in more loss than gain for Western civilization. The Latin Kingdom of Constantinople diverted many able warriors to the more pleasant and nearer lands in Greece, Cyprus, and the Anatolian coast, so that a large crusading host was impossible to gather for the relief of Syria. And there were no more large crusades after this. Louis IX had two crusades, but none to measure up to the first three. Rather than give aid to Jerusalem, it robbed her of potential help. This is one significance of it. It contributed toward the decline of the crusading ideal. Secondly, the pillage of Constantinople saw the destruction of timeless masterpieces, irreplaceable mosaics and sculptures, together with large and beautiful churches, and we might also say a good share of precious literary works. During the two centuries which preceded the attack on Constantinople, she had successfully repelled the assaults of the Turks from the east. She represented a bastion of defense, and if you've ever looked at the archaeology, I shouldn't say archaeology, the geography around Constantinople on the map, you can see this is an impregnable fortress. She represented a bastion of defense, an ever-present threat to the designs of the Moslems. Now, Piers says this: had the Byzantine Empire not been destroyed by the Fourth Crusade, there is good reason to believe that it would shortly have recovered its strength, have continued its struggle, and that the Turks with Genghis Khan on one side and the imperial troops on the other would have been annihilated. Had Constantinople not fallen in 1204, says Piers and many others, chances are that Luther and his contemporaries would never have been frightened by the appearance of the Turks at the gates of Vienna, because they would never have gotten that far. The leadership of Eastern Christianity began to pass away from the Mediterranean with the fall of Constantinople. It passed from the Mediterranean to the plains of Russia. As Runciman says, the second Rome was giving place to the third Rome of Muscovy. The movements toward the unity of Latin and Greek churches had heretofore faltered, but following the sack of Constantinople, the Greeks largely dismissed the possibility of such a union ever being consummated. Constantinople was capable of resisting attack from the east. She was not prepared, however, to resist both east and west. In the fall of 1204, Edwin Piers sees a necessary prelude to the catastrophe of 1453. The one is difficult to conceive without the other. Finally, the sack of Constantinople did have a beneficent effect in that it brought about a revolution in trade which affected the West materially. The rise of the middle class was notably enhanced by the increase in commerce between Italy and the Levant. As John W. Thompson says, the Fourth Crusade constitutes the most important revolution in the history of Levantine trade between the decline of the Roman Empire and the discovery of the sea route to India in 1498. In other words, John Thompson says this is the most important economic event in Europe from 400 to 1400. Let me conclude with this one sentence. Though some benefits may have accrued to the West as a result of the Fourth Crusade, it still remains one of history's great tragedies. Do you have any questions?